Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by the co-founder of The Bulwark, Bill Kristol. Good to be with you again, Bill.
And good to be with you, Charlie.
Well, you know, this is, again, one of these, we're looking back on the week that was, and there's so much. I was talking with David Priest on the podcast yesterday that we're now compressing whole year's worth of news into 12-hour periods, and this has been an amazing week. I don't want to have what happened in Minneapolis lost, though. I mean, we have all of the developments with the Ukrainian scandal, the momentum on impeachment, what we're learning about Rudy Giuliani, the testimony of the former Ukrainian ambassador, all of that. But then we had this extraordinary performance by the President of the United States, which I'm sometimes afraid that we normalize it. Let me just play a little bit of the president going to Minneapolis and not just attacking Joe Biden and Barack Obama and others, but specifically singling out Somali refugees for attack.
For many years, leaders in Washington brought large numbers of refugees to your state from Somalia without considering the impact on schools and communities and taxpayers. I promise you that as president, I would give local communities a greater say in refugee policy and put in place enhanced vetting and responsible immigration controls. And I've done that. Since coming into office, I have reduced refugee resettlement by 85%. And as you know, maybe especially in Minnesota, I kept another promise. I issued an executive action making clear that no refugees will be resettled in any city or any state without the express written consent of that city or that state. So speak to your mayor.
Okay, Bill Kristol, what do you make of the president's rally in Minneapolis?
You know, I'm glad we're beginning with that. I was just on TV a little while ago. We're speaking Friday afternoon, and we were going to discuss the Ukraine thing. And I actually asked Andrew Mitchell, you know, could we just begin with a rally? Because everything gets so, as you sort of suggested earlier, everything gets so overtaken by events so quickly these days that he says outrageous things and presents himself and reveals himself in a certain way. And then, of course, you know, you're on to something else, which is important also, and one forgets. So I do think last night was pretty amazing. I guess I would just say this. Every Republican elected official who has signed on to support Trump, even if reluctantly, for 2020, every donor who's written a check, every supporter and voter who's told himself, yeah, I really guess I'm on board for another 4 years, they need to watch that rally. And they need to look in the mirror and tell themselves, I'm fine with him, not just as president now, not just for the next year. Maybe he shouldn't be convicted if impeached. That's a separate debate. But I'm fine with him for an additional 4 years. I mean, he is a disturbed person. When you he is the narcissism, the anger. What does one even begin to describe it? I actually was looking around this morning to see you've written about it. Pete Wehner, our friend, has written about it. And about a month ago, he had an excellent piece in The Atlantic, which was, again, so much stuff happens. I remember reading it at the time, thought this is a good piece. And then, of course, it got overtaken by 9,000 events. But it's more on Trump sort of psychologically as opposed to the politics, the merits, the corruption, all the other stuff. And I think it was a very astute piece. In any case, just laid out for people, this is the man who is our president. And I do think, insofar as we have people listening to this podcast and thinking about this and talking to others, just people need to look themselves in the eye and look others in the eye and say, yes, I'm on board for him for another 4 years. If they can watch that and say they think it's fine, they think there's no problem with the unbelievably demagogic attack on recent refugees. They have no problem with the attack on Vice President Biden and President Obama and the vulgarity of that. They have no problem with imitating the texts of whatever you think of them and, you know, two FBI agents who did serve this country. And in any case, if they did things wrong, they have in fact paid some price and so forth. But the president personally singling them out and mocking them, if they're fine with all that, and if they're fine with having our politics continue down this path for the next 5 years, then I guess they should write their check to the Trump campaign. But otherwise, maybe they should think twice.
Yeah, two things struck me about that, the little soundbite that we played. Number one is that refugees are not illegal immigrants. This is something new. He's focusing on people who've actually followed the law, who have, resettled legally in Minnesota. The fact that they are black is not irrelevant. But what also struck me was that he's ripping the Somalis, and this crowd is cheering him. And so, yes, everything you said, and of course I agree with everything you said, what Peter Weiner has written, what George Conway has written in The Atlantic as well about the president, what Jonathan Last has written about the president being unwell. But it's also disturbing that there is that base out there that looks at all of this narcissism, the dishonesty, the bullying, all of that, and they're going, we like this.
It's a good point. I'd focus a little more on the other side of his behavior last night, but no, it's terrible. I mean, look, so as I understand, I'm not an expert on the refugee programs. I know that in the case of Northern Virginia, we were one of the main resettlement areas for the Vietnamese boat people who came over in 1975, and then some subsequent East Vietnamese and Cambodians who escaped. It was a great thing, honestly, for Northern Virginia. I'm willing to believe that assimilating the Somalians, who come from a very different culture and economic background and so forth, is more difficult, perhaps, and there have been problems and all. But yeah, to scapegoat them, to demonize them, to demagogue them in front of this crowd, instead of as president of the United States saying, look, I pay tribute to you in Minnesota. You've taken on a bit of a burden here. And maybe the federal government should do a little more to help the schools and the hospitals. I don't, know what policies are in place. I'm sure they get some funding for that. Maybe they should get more and so forth. Instead of taking that tone, which is what any normal president of either party would have said if one of his advisors had said, sir, you're going to – I say sir, like Trump tells these sir stories. Mr. President, you're going to Minneapolis. It's a big issue there. Something of an issue there. You probably should address it. Here's what we'd, what you might say. And of course, any president would say something like that, reassuring, maybe we'll do a little better. But, the opposite here. I mean, a total scapegoating of them in a way that's really terrible. And then to have the crowd think that, as you say, these are refugees. They're there legally. They didn't come over and say, I want to go to Minneapolis, I suspect. They came over and said, thank you, America, for taking us. And the American government said, well, we decided that this would be a reasonable place for, decent economic prospects and so forth for you to resettle. So it really is outrageous. And incidentally, it's a free country. They can move to and from there, and others can move there. And so the notion that, local communities are going to, what are we going to do now? Start when you show up, when you, Charlie Sykes, move from, one place to another, are you going to have to have a permit to move from Milwaukee to, Green Bay or something, or to D.C.? I mean, is this the kind of country we want to live in? That is, in a way, what Donald Trump's vision of the country is, though, isn't it? Especially if you have maybe dark skin, right?
It was, yes. It was genuinely ugly. And, okay, so let's just switch gears, too, because I want to get to this larger, trying to frame, which I think we're all struggling with, which is what actually moves the needle, if anything? Has anything changed? This seems like it has been a momentous week. So I want to we're going to work up to this. So I'm looking at the New York Times account of what happened Friday morning when the former Ukrainian ambassador Marie Yovanovitch testified in closed door. Now, what we found out was that the Trump State Department had tried to block her testimony, had told her not to go, and that the House Intelligence Committee then issued a subpoena, and she walked through those doors, and she delivered blistering testimony. Here's the paragraph. In a closed-door interview that could further fuel calls for Mr. Trump's impeachment, Ms. Yovanovitch delivered a scathing indictment of how his administration conducts foreign policy. She warned that private influence and personal gain have usurped diplomats' judgment, threatening to undermine the nation's interest and drive talented professionals out of public service. And she said that diplomats no longer have confidence that their government will have our backs and protect us if we come under attack from foreign interests. That was remarkable. That is a remarkable moment in this unfolding story, isn't it?
I think it is. I think the week has been remarkable. Just to step back for a second beyond the week. So I do think in the last month, I mean, we're so used to things not really changing. Mm-hmm. Trump support's right. Pretty solid. The Mueller report didn't really move the needle. We had two big things that happened, obviously. The House Democrats, who had been holding off full-throatedly embracing an impeachment inquiry under the leadership of Speaker Pelosi, moved, and she followed her troops, I think, in this case, after the Ukraine story broke and the sort of gravity of it was fully realized. So on the one hand, so we really have an impeachment inquiry, if not authorized by the House, but called that by everyone in authority in the House happening. And secondly, the polls moved. I think that's a big deal. We're so used to not seeing the polls move. Stuff comes out that you and I think, oh, my mm-hmm. God, this is horrible. And then it changes. You know, the polls change 0.5 percentage point. And they moved pretty substantially on impeachment. Enough of them have moved now that it's pretty hard to say that it's not random. So something about the Ukraine story, maybe combined with a broader sense of his conduct and where things might be going, has moved some number of voters kind of in the middle over to being favorable to at least an impeachment inquiry, and actually to a surprising degree to impeachment and removal mm-hmm. themselves. So those two things that happened already. And then we have the further developments of this week with the testimony today by former ambassador to Ukraine, and then I think coming up next week, the former National Security Council director for Russia and Eastern Europe, who this was her area, Fiona Hill.
That's going to be a big deal. Yeah.
Yes, and then I think we also have the Ambassador Sondland, who the Trump donor, the ambassador to the EU, who, for me, having been in government a little, even though years ago, one of the most striking things about the whole account was what is that guy doing there? I mean, it's, you know,
money.
Why is he on these calls? Well, he's on these calls because he's Trump's guy. And they didn't trust Giuliani, and Trump didn't trust the ambassador. They didn't trust the DCM, Mr. Taylor. And they wanted someone who understood what they wanted in the middle of this. So they take the ambassador to the EU in Brussels. Ukraine's not even part of the EU. And in any case, it has nothing to do with the EU business, what was being – even the legitimate version of what's being discussed has nothing to do with EU affairs. And they put him on the calls, and he's in the middle of everything. And he calls Trump and then texts mm-hmm. back, remember, to Taylor and so forth. So the degree of sort of monkey business that's going on there, that for me was a big alarm bell of his centrality to the – story. Now, maybe, you know, look, a president's entitled to use people out of their lane. And if he thinks Sondland's trustworthy, he can get involved in Ukraine policy. But it seems like it's a little more than that. And that's why I think the fact that he seems to be saying he's going to testify on Thursday, even though they had stopped him from testifying. What was that, earlier this week, mm-hmm. last week? Who could even keep track of time anymore? You know, that's a big deal. So it feels like things are now mounting up and more evidence will accumulate, which I think will confirm what we kind of already know, right? Which is the Ukraine policy was not a serious foreign policy choice. It was entirely driven by, it looks like, two things now: Trump's personal political interests vis-a-vis Biden, and the financial interests of, if not Trump himself, though maybe Trump himself, certainly people very close to Trump like Giuliani.
Yeah, this really is stunning. And of course, on Friday, the Washington Post, you know, reported at least four national security officials were so alarmed by the Trump administration's attempts to pressure Ukraine for political purposes that they raised concerns with a White House lawyer both before and immediately after President Trump's July 25th call with that country's president, according to U.S. officials and other people familiar with the matter. Okay, so as this develops, and of course, we have the arrest of the Giuliani cronies, which who knows where that can unravel, you know, where those dots are going to go, because this does feel like this has become much, much more dangerous for Rudy Giuliani and much, much more difficult now for Trump world to dismiss this as simply the deep state. But in the midst of this, as this story is exploding, as the House is moving very clearly toward an almost certain, I think certain, vote of impeachment, and therefore, you know, a removal trial in the Senate, the president gets on the phone with the president of Turkey, the authoritarian president of Turkey, Erdogan, his buddy, and impulsively decides to betray our allies, the Kurds, and sets off in this entire other narrative, which has clearly rattled some of the Republican base. I mean, some of the things that are coming out of Republicans who have been incredibly reluctant. So just give me your take on what's going on in the Middle East, including that remarkable scene at the UN Security Council where the United States aligns itself with Russia as opposed to our allies in refusing to condemn the Turkish invasion.
Now, that's a very revealing moment. Look, I mean, foreign policy is full of difficult decisions, and sometimes they're morally, you know, wrenching and problematic decisions. But what's amazing about this is there was no – so at times you have to decide, and you have to decide the least bad of different alternatives. There was no need to decide here. Our troops were there. The situation wasn't great, but it was, you know, adequate if compared to the alternatives, compared to what we're now seeing. And Trump decides apparently simply to please Erdogan – though, and who knows whether that's just because he likes dictators or because he has this kind of thing about we can't have troops anyway. You know, anything that looks like pulling out troops is he's for, even though he's not pulling out that many, in fact, and is sending more to Saudi Arabia today. So, so much for the reducing the U.S. footprint in the Middle East, right? but he likes Saudi Arabia and he likes MBS and he likes that dictatorship. And he's not keen on leaving troops in a place where they actually could save lives. I mean, think about that parallel, incidentally. Within a week, you pull the troops out of a place where they're clearly saving lives, preventing terrible things from happening, contributing to some degree, it's not a huge success, but it's a story, but contributing to some degree to, let's say, preventing things from getting worse in a very difficult situation in Syria. They're doing playing an important role there. He pulls them out there and then sends 2,000 more to Saudi. I don't even know what they're doing there. I guess they could bolster Saudi defenses against Iran a little bit, but I mean, I don't know. But whatever the merits or demerits, it's striking that suddenly all of his principles about getting troops home and all this seem to evaporate. So I think that really has struck people. And I agree very much that Republican members, and not just Republicans, are really appalled by it. And for me, it comes down to this. 2 years ago, when you and I made the exact same arguments about Trump's nature and his irresponsibility and his unfitness for the presidency, people would say, yeah, but look, so it's like some guy's in the Oval Office. He's issuing idiotic orders and wishing things to happen. But Don McGahn's not letting him fire Mueller. And Jim Mattis isn't letting him do totally irresponsible things. And H.R. McMaster, and et cetera, et cetera. And there was some truth to that, actually, I would say, in 2017, 2018, right? What's really striking, I think the reason senior people on the Hill, I've heard from a couple of senators in just the last 2 days, are rattled, is it's not the case anymore that we have a president who's at times an embarrassment, at times very willful, very irresponsible, but is constrained and checked. We have a president who's now got an administration where he decides to do something and people hop to it and start to do it. And the Syria thing in that respect, it's a terrible decision in its own right, but it's also in a way that the tip of an iceberg of other decisions that could follow and could happen with no McMaster, no Mattis, no Kelly, no et cetera, right? I mean, so I think that and Foreign Service being hollowed out and Rudy Giuliani running around, you know, pursuing his personal financial interests and Bill Barr pursuing Trump's crazed theory about 2016 and it was Ukraine, not Russia. I mean, the degree to which you look at that and you think the whole U.S. government is now being distorted and manipulated in a way that wasn't quite the case just, you know, a couple of years ago, that is really worrisome.
So you mentioned two things I want to follow up on, the senators being rattled and the absence of these adults in the room. If I'm reading my Twitter feed correctly, Jim Mattis has agreed to go on Meet the Press this weekend.
Oh, you're ahead of me on that. Okay, that should be interesting.
Yeah. Again, we don't know whether he's going to break his silence. I mean, he famously said that he wasn't going to say anything, but that may not apply, you know, at all times. That should be interesting. I see that H.R. McMaster is becoming more vocal. And I think this is one of the dynamics that we've seen over the last several days of, you know, is the critical mass of more people willing to come forward. And how that changes the dynamic. Okay, the other point, you know, we've had lots of reports of senators being rattled in private, the emphasis being in private, furrowing their brows, et cetera. Do you sense a change in their attitude other than just simply shaking their head more often? I mean, has anything actually changed?
So I'd say two things. I mean, one, they are just more worried than they were, I think, in the past. I mean, the fact that even when Mattis resigned in December and Brett McGurk resigned, remember, Trump then reversed the decision. So people had kind of gotten used to irresponsible ideas, irresponsible threats, irresponsible even announcements, and then kind of mostly get walked back. And now, unfortunately, there's not much – even there, even this one, there's a tiny bit of walking back. But basically, we're now in a horrible situation in Syria. So I think that's got people rattled. And secondly, I think members of the House and the Senate are realizing they actually may have to vote on something. That is to say, it's one thing to people like you and I would say, you should speak up. And they would say, what's the point? I mean, we can't change Trump much and we're getting some good things out of this. And we'd say, you should vote against him on some issues. And they'd say, look, these issues aren't that emergency declaration. They're not really that important. And what's the point of picking a fight with them? And then on some issues, they just agree with the administration. So they're voting for, you know, tax cuts and so forth, or judges. I mean, this, they haven't really had a vote. I was trying to think about this. I mean, do you think, I don't think they really had an up or down vote where they are going to be forced to vote. Is what Trump has done acceptable or not? As a House member, they're going to have to vote on presumably on articles of impeachment in committee and on the floor. And as a senator, they're going to have to vote to convict or not. And they can, of course, all choose not to vote to impeach and convict. And, you know, it doesn't reach the level of impeachment. But it is a clear vote on Trump's actual conduct in office. It's not a vote on, you know, that's sort of a vote of confidence in Trump, but that isn't directly about Trump, you know, which is what some of the previous votes have been. So I think that's got them sort of focused in a way where in the past they could duck and dodge and, hey, Bill, you know, hey, Charlie, I'm in favor of some of these things. So I know you don't like Trump, but on the other hand, they surely should build the border wall, blah, blah, blah. Now it's, are you okay with the president of the United States doing what it's clear Trump has done?
So Lamar Alexander, who is retiring, who I think is one of the old guard who really needs to be watched, I mean, who should be watched with a great deal of interest, issued a statement basically saying that he did not find the president's behavior acceptable, but he did not think that it rose to the level of impeachment. That seems to be kind of a sweet spot for some of these Republicans, that they can in fact say it's not acceptable, but then not commit themselves to impeachment.
And they may be able to stay there if we don't learn much more, I would say. But it's not like there's only one phone call and only one transcript, I imagine, we're going to get. It's not like there aren't meetings and emails and discussions that presumably we'll learn about that either directly involved Trump or had people citing Trump's authority in the case perhaps of the ambassador to Ukraine or Fiona Hill. She was actually in the White House. So I suspect it's going to get it may end up being where it is. We don't really learn much more. It was kind of Trump never really quite pulled the trigger, but that's not true. The other thing we're learning more about is the delaying of the aid. I was struck, there was an article today, there's so many who can keep track, right? But this was like the fifth or tenth most important article of the day. It turns out the Defense Department General Counsel, I believe, the legal office of defense, had an internal opinion at least that the holding up of the aid was not just unwise, it was illegal. Congress had appropriated it. The defense, one of the assistant secretaries of defense had sent a long memorandum specifying what was going to go. This was appropriated funds from Congress. Defense was getting ready to do it. Then it gets held up in the White House with no rationale, no apparently paperwork, just the president isn't, you know, quite there. So we're going to hold it up. I mean, so that kind of thing will start to come out. And I think the notion that, you know, we can live with all this, there were real actions and real consequences here. It wasn't just Trump was nasty to President Zelensky or Trump would have loved to see some dirt on Joe Biden. Trump held up hundreds of millions of dollars of aid to a country that had been invaded by Russia, you know, a few years before.
Well, also, I think I'm trying to look up the article right now. The decision was shifted over to a guy who was the former executive director of the Wisconsin Republican
Yes,
Party.
I thought of you when I read that. So you must know him, right?
Well, the guy's a complete hack. I mean, it's like, how did this guy get into this position to be making this kind of a decision? And that's why all of this feels so shaky. Is that the president is clearly up against the more talented and experienced people in the defense community, in the diplomatic community, and he's relying on people who have either clearly lost it, like Rudy Giuliani, or just, you know, political third raters like this guy. So, I mean, just weird.
Well, I think serious people who've been in government a little bit and respect the rules and laws of our government and our country would say, Mr. President, you can't. I mean, this aid was appropriated. It's gone through all the relevant checks within the executive branch. We need to send it. You can go to Congress and say, you know what, we should rescind this appropriation because it's not necessary. You can do other things to make an argument for why it shouldn't happen. But you can't just sort of secretly stop it from happening with murky orders within the White House through this, you know, as you say, this political guy at OMB. So I do think that's, yeah, I mean, he has to resort to people like this because I think, honestly, serious people are not going to obey those orders.
You know, I mentioned the Lamar Alexander statement, which I didn't think went far enough. I mean, I don't agree with him. I think that the behavior obviously does warrant impeachment or certain impeachment inquiry, which is where Larry Hogan came down. Governor of Maryland said that he also, you know, favors an impeachment inquiry. But here's the contrast. Did you see the videotapes of Cory Gardner out in Colorado who's running, running for re-election, and he's asked the question, is it ever appropriate for an American politician or the president to ask a foreign country for this kind of assistance? And he gives this very weak, canned answer, you know, about partisanship and everything. He's asked multiple times. It's a terrible videotape. And it really raises the question, like, why couldn't, you know, is he that afraid of a negative tweet from Trump? Is he that cowed that he can't go to the Lamar Alexander sweet spot? Because that seems to be like a holding place. So what are guys like Cory Gardner afraid of? Is this the mood in Trump world that you cannot, you know, show any sort of a crack if you're running for re-election?
It is amazing, isn't it? I mean, Lamar, I guess, can go to that, quote, sweet spot, you know, what you call a sweet spot, because he's not running for re-election. Even so, as you say, it's not going quite as far as he might end up going or as he might actually believe deep down. But Cory Gardner can't even say it. I mean, H.R. McMaster, the president's former national security advisor, who said he didn't personally witness anything like this, and so he was sort of half defending Trump from his tenure, nonetheless said that it would be wrong. It was flat out definitive on would it be wrong for a president to make this kind of request, and he said yes. Maybe one reason Cory Gardner doesn't want to say yes is that he's worried that there's going to be more and more and more evidence that the president, of course, did make this request, and then people are going to say, well, you said this was wrong. The president did what was wrong. Are you going to now act on it? Well, then he can say, yes, it was wrong, but not quite impeachable, I suppose. But I think he doesn't even want to go down that path. But that's where I think the dynamic kicks in. We were talking about this a little bit earlier. Why is this different? The dynamic kicks in because he is going to have to vote, most likely. And he is going to have to explain his vote. And so he can't, you know, he can hide from the cameras right now. But at the end of the day, he'll have to vote and probably explain his vote on the floor of the Senate. And that's a little more of a challenge to these people, I think.
Here's a maybe just sort of a sign of the time, and I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think Trump's going to be removed or that he's not going to win renomination. But the Washington Post has a thing called a ranking committee, and they ask the question, so if Trump gets removed, who's the GOP nominee? The fact that people are even talking about that. And I actually got an email from a guy who is, you know, is very conservative, and he's pro-Trump, not because he's pro-Trump, but because he's pro-conservative judges. And what he was saying is, so, you know, is there any way that it could be, you know, President Pence or Nikki Haley? Is there any other alternative? So for the first time, I'm getting the vibe that at least the idea is out there. Okay, you know, is there a real conservative alternative to Trump? And I just thought it was interesting that they would even, you know, have this. And their ranking is number one, it would be Mike Pence. Number two, it would be Mitt Romney. Number three, Nikki Haley. Number four, Tom Cotton. Number five, Josh Hawley. Number six, Jeff Flake. And then, of course, it's all silly, you know. But
no, but I think the core point you're making isn't silly, and I think it's real, which is, I mean, I was joking with a Democrat here in D.C. the other day, just ran into somewhere, that I mean, Trump has much of the Republican base believing, and a lot of Republican donors and even elected officials pretending to believe, that if he were to be impeached and convicted, removed from office, that literally Hillary Clinton or Nancy Pelosi would become president the next day. And it's like people have just lost, you know, their senses in a way and aren't thinking, you know, beyond their visceral dislike of Trump's enemies and opponents and their instinctive defense of Trump. I said jokingly that, you know, it would actually be helpful if Nancy Pelosi, she can't really probably say this quite, but said, you know what, I'm not going to become president. Mike Pence is going to become president. And that's a little complicated, but she can't give Mike Pence a clean, you know, a clean bill of health at this point either. So what if he was involved in all this? And so it's a little awkward for how she could frame this. But it wouldn't hurt for people to start reminding, including Democrats, to say, you know what, Mike Pence is a very conservative guy. I dealt with him in the House. He's a decent human being, but he's very, very conservative. I don't really relish the thought of a Pence presidency. But that's what's going to happen if Trump's – you do understand that, don't you?
No.
Republican members of the House and Republican people in the crowd screaming last night that if Trump is removed, you get his vice president, whom he selected and who has been in the White House for 3 years. And frankly, from our point of view, has been involved in things that he probably shouldn't have been involved in. But let's just leave that aside for a minute. You know, becoming president of the United States, you're not giving the White House. He can appoint the conservative judge, the same conservative judges that Trump would have appointed. The Senate composition doesn't change. He can pursue the same deregulatory policies Trump would have pursued. I mean, people, I do think just a little bit of a splash of cold water on people's faces might awake some of them. awaken some of them to that fact. And then, like your friend, they start thinking, well, gee, I don't know, would Pence, a Pence-Haley ticket, would that be so terrible to have in 2020 as opposed to Trump again?
Yeah, right now that might be the fever dream of some people. Okay, so well, there's been all of this focus on, well, what is Congress going to do? Looking at the polls, what is the Republican base going to do? I think an equally important question is the GOP donor class, because in terms of what's happened to the Republican Party, the GOP donor class's decision to go all in on Trump has had tremendous consequences. It had tremendous consequences for conservative ink, for conservative media, for, you know, what is acceptable. Do you sense any anxiety or any concern? Is there any prospect that there might be a break in that group?
You know, I think it's a very important question, actually. I just personally haven't dealt with enough of them in the last week or two to have any real feel, and I haven't heard much one way or the other. But I think the email you got is indicative of a certain, I mean, there's certainly unease. They're not foolish people necessarily, and they will follow the news. And they, whether they're hearing privately from their own senators, if they have Republican senators, that, gee, this is pretty bad. I mean, the ones who care about foreign policy, and that is some chunk of them, care about the Middle East. Looking at what's happening there, I just think, I come back to what I said earlier. They've been able to deceive themselves. I think you and I would think it's deceiving, but let's say they've been able to reassure themselves that, you know, he's kind of a jerk and he's foolish and erratic and I don't like him and I wish he wouldn't do those things. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really, really affect the fundamental interests of the U.S., either at home or abroad. I think that's kind of been the place that they've landed where they can rationalize their support for, at least acquiescence to Trump. I think after Syria, this is why Syria is important. After Syria, that's a very hard thing to say. And then they start thinking, gee, and what is, you know, if he does this with Syria, could he do it with other countries and other situations? And someone gets to him and has a conversation and suddenly he's changing our policy on A, B, or C. I think that is a bit of, I don't know if it's really a game changer, but it's at least a potential game changer.
Okay, just switching gears a bit. I spend a good deal of time with a prominent Democratic strategist, let's put it that way. And it was an off-the-record conversation, so I'm not going to name him. I'm sure you've had similar conversations. And I was expecting this individual to be rather pro-Joe Biden, and I was a little taken aback by his reservations. You know, thinking that Joe Biden, you know, has in fact lost a step, and then pointing to his failure to respond to some of the Trump attacks. Yes, he finally gave the, you know, strong speech, but it took about 2 weeks. And he said, you know, just this is an indication of the decision making process that we're seeing from the Biden world, is it takes them 2 weeks to figure out what they're going to do, which, as you and I know, is just way too long. And so there was the concern about his age, his reflexes, and his judgment on all of this, which raises the question, you know, given we've talked about this many times, but now it seems a little bit more real. If it's not Joe Biden, are you worried that the Democrats are going to put a candidate up who is going to be, you know, the one person that causes a lot of swing voters to hold their nose and say, okay, at least we know what Donald Trump is. We're just going to go with him.
Yes, I am worried. I think, you know, on the whole, Trump is behaving so badly now that I suspect people can overcome an awful lot of reservations about even a quite liberal or in other ways a Democrat or someone they don't like much for other reasons, just because they'll figure, okay, one term of this person, we can survive that. But no, I think it's risky for them to take on board a lot of the candidates. Elizabeth Warren, I suppose, is the most important one, since she right now you'd have to rank as a co-favorite with Biden, I think, for the nomination. It's one thing to take one or two positions that put off people a little bit or, you know, worry people or scare people even. She's got four or five or six at this point, and they're enough to appeal to different groups too. So she's got, you know, social conservatives can tell themselves, we just can't abide a Warren presidency, and fiscal, you know, Wall Street types and free market types. And when you say free market, that's like such an old fashioned notion that you and I still believe in, but pro-business types will say she'll just, you know, destroy our industry and she's against fracking. So how does that go in Pennsylvania? And I mean, you could write a scenario where someone like a fair number of voters flee Warren. I wouldn't say you've seen it exactly in the polls yet, but of course, we haven't really litigated these issues in a general election context. I can argue this one either way. Part of me thinks, you know, it is always about the incumbent. People in 1980 thought Reagan was the weakest Republican candidate.
I remember.
What moderate would go to Reagan? Yeah. They would go to Ford. They would go to Bush. They would go to Howard Baker. He was fine. So maybe that's, in that respect, it's always about the incumbent. But on the other hand, we've also seen times when obviously the incumbent has discredited or damaged a challenger, and you know Trump's going to have $1 billion. And so I do think in that respect, the fact that the more moderate candidate is, you know, is generally thought perhaps not to have the best campaign and maybe has, as you say, lost a step. And the less moderate candidate has run a good campaign, mostly, I'd say, Elizabeth Warren, but could put off swing voters. That's not an ideal situation.
No, it's not an ideal situation. And because she does, you know, has checked so many of those boxes, but I'm having a hard time coming up with a scenario in which if Biden fades, that there's another moderate candidate out there who would have enough juice to take on the progressive wing of the party. I mean, it seems more likely to me right now the Bernie Sanders will continue to fade. And by the way, this is not because I don't wish him good, you know, don't have good wishes for him given his health. But you kind of get the sense that you know, may hobble that campaign. So that if he begins to fade, she begins to consolidate her support, and you know, if she wins in Iowa and New Hampshire, and if African Americans decide that, well, she's electable, then it's game over, isn't it? I mean, at least in terms of the Democratic primary.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I mean, the other argument would be A, Biden just stays stronger than we think, or B,
which is possible, or B,
Biden fades in a way so quickly that this time for a second tier, more moderate candidate to emerge as an alternative to Warren, and that could happen, obviously. So who knows? I mean, I think there is a real scenario where on February 11th, I think is the day maybe of New Hampshire, mm-hmm. So on February 12th, something around Lincoln's birthday, we have a situation where Trump probably is going to be, let's assume he's impeached but not convicted, probably going to be renominated, and Warren's probably going to be the Democratic candidate. And then people are saying, well, can we do a third party or independent candidate? But would that just elect Trump? I mean, it could be could Warren adjust to be acceptable to a certain number of independents? I don't know. I do think at the end of the day, the incumbent, the judgment of the incumbent outweighs everything else.
I mean,
Elizabeth Warren isn't, you know, going to control Congress with an iron hand. The Democrats may or may not win the Senate, but even so, there are enough, you know, moderate Democratic senators that she's not going to sort of nationalize half the industries in the country or, you know, totally transform, you know, everything right away. So I tend to think Trump dominates everything else as an issue, but I do agree there are riskier paths for the Democrats and less risky paths, and they may be getting ready to take a fairly risky path.
I think so. By the way, while we're talking here, I know we both felt very, very strongly about the president's invocation of his emergency powers to bypass Congress's power of the purse on the wall. And I'm seeing a tweet here that a federal court has ruled the Trump administration's national emergency declaration to build that border wall was illegal. So cool. We will see where that goes. The president is not on a winning streak in the courts in the last 48 hours.
Yeah, you know, you take on all these things and you might find some of the judges might be rendering judgments that, you know, you and I might not agree with if we looked at them closely. But, you know, in the reality of the world, the courts are split between Republican and Democratic appointees, and some of them probably don't like President Trump much, and maybe that's percolating into their opinions, or maybe not. Maybe these are actually correct opinions, and I'm sure it's a combination of that. But yeah, you do pay some price when you take on everyone on everything at one time. But I think especially the contempt he's shown for the rule of law, the contempt he's shown for the very notion of a kind of due process and so forth, it's got to spill over. And if you're an honest judge, not a partisan one, and you're just trying to do the right thing, but a lot of these are very close calls, right? And there's probably some law on both sides, and there's some arguments on both sides. I don't think it's even illegitimate for a judge to step back at that point and think to himself, well, what is the broader consequence of what I rule here? Am I going to inadvertently sort of give a green light or yellow light to an administration that's shown it's willing to run roughshod over things? Or am I going to err a little bit on the other side and put up a yellow or red light, even though maybe in other circumstances this would just make it over the line of being acceptable? You know, I think judges do think that way. They're human beings, and it's not even wrong for them to think this way. And I do think Trump is probably paying a bit of a price for his own behavior here.
So going back to the question that I wanted to frame, which was what has changed, I think you identified it. And I think, you know, part of the problem is that we have been locked into this pattern, you know, since 2017 where nothing matters, nothing changes anything. And we've had endless conversations about, well, this is going to be the problem. And again, as you pointed out, you know, the polls move, you know, 0.1%. And what we have seen in the last several weeks has been the fact that something is moving those numbers. And those numbers on impeachment are genuinely surprising, and they represent something genuinely new. And, you know, maybe that's why there's this, I just have a feeling that this is different. But since I've said this so many times before, I'm really, really hesitant to do it. But you are right. We've done this, and we haven't seen, I mean, his approval rating has been impervious to events until now.
I think on that note, we should stop, because of course God knows what'll happen over the weekend to change everything one more time, right?
Well,
could be a new moment. I do think I've always thought that the combination of the Ukraine thing, which was not predictable, I suppose, of him making a phone call from the Oval Office, as opposed to what happened in a campaign with people who were close to him meeting with people they shouldn't have met with and so forth. That's a pretty big difference. And then just the kind of focusing of the attention that the actual impeachment inquiry forces, and the kind of, okay, well, this is the judgment. And then also the re-election. I think all of it coming together. Because again, I think it's much easier retrospectively to be semi-defending things he's done, or saying, well, you know, it didn't work out that terribly, and NATO still exists, even though he has said irresponsible things. Do you have confidence? Does one have confidence? This is what I would say, maybe to close, to people who are sort of still grudgingly supporting Trump. Do you have confidence after this week with Syria that NATO will still exist if he has a second term? Do we have confidence that he won't get angry at the Chancellor of Germany and just really blow it up? I mean, that's what seems to me to have changed from 2 years ago to today.
Bill Kristol, thanks once again for joining us. I appreciate it very much. Have a great weekend.
You too, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.